From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for December 27th, 2015, the last Sunday of the year 2015. Thanks for joining me as we take our weekly look at politics, and we've got a special show planned for today, so it's time to grab the Sunday paper, that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get things headed off to a good start as we approach 2016. Well, I hope all of you out there are having a good holiday season. I hope you had a good Christmas. Dave, Jasmine, I hope you both got everything that you were hoping Santa was going to bring you.
I did.
You did?
I hope Jasmine did too.
I did.
All right.
Well, what'd you get?
I got a new, you know, the Beats headphones?
Yeah.
I got those, and I really wanted them.
Very
and they're
nice.
Wireless, so they're awesome.
Very nice. Very nice. What about you, Dave?
Oh, a couple of videos that I was asking for, and also some...
Videos that everybody can see?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
just,
yes.
Just wanted to check there.
I'm not in college anymore.
Oh, okay.
Here.
All right.
No, I've got a couple of videos that I had requested, and some clothing items as well, but also some quality time with my dad and some friends. Really some extended time this Christmas. Didn't have to kind of eat and run. Was here Christmas morning, which seems to be part of the tradition. But,
right.
You know, the rest of the day and into the evening there was nice and peaceful. Had a little challenge with the Christmas dinner as well prepared as my dad always is for these meals. For some reason, that ham just didn't get warm enough. So the microwave was in action. Worked out great. And the remaining portion of the ham is making some awesome sandwiches.
Oh, so, I bet. So, or you could have brought that in and fried up some eggs and. That could have been
that,
breakfast.
And that,
this
and
morning.
The homemade cookies that were homemade from I don't know how many neighbors. But boy, it's always good. So, yeah, good Christmas all the way around.
Yeah, no, it's, and as you said, it's, you know, the quality time, that kind of thing. I got to have some quality time with my daughters, including my daughter Kate, the senior from Mizzou. Who was back home, and I actually had taken a pledge that on Christmas Day I was going to be off the digital grid, which is actually a good thing every now and then.
It is.
And so I stayed off the digital grid, but my daughter Kate decided that to pay homage to Ice Cube, that we had to do a Gangsta Pearson Christmas picture in front of the Christmas tree.
It's a neat picture, actually.
Well, and she posts it on Facebook, which I didn't really know till post midnight when I got back on the grid, and it's got like 120 likes on it. And I'm thinking, okay. And then I posted the more traditional kind of picture, but yeah, and it was funny. All of these likes coming from all over the country, all kinds of people. You know, Jimmy DeCastro here at the radio station. Jeff Zeleny, my buddy, who's does politics for CNN. And so I guess I sent Kate a note saying, did you see how many people like this picture? And she goes, yeah, Dad, I'm really feeling embarrassed about this. And then she goes, no, I'm not. She goes, I've never had so many likes on a picture ever before. So, yeah, so but it was fun. Great dinner, great chatting with both daughters. Amanda, our unofficial music director, who promises to be sending us some more bumps here in the near future of as we try to stay topical.
That'll be great to hear. As good as the Christmas stuff sounds.
Yeah, that isn't that always nice.
It's great.
And she yes, and she acknowledged how embarrassed she was, but she. She said it did remind her of her days back at the U of I and the a cappella group, the Ripcords. And
it's hard to sing a cappella without going, you know, off pitch, sharp or flat, as they say in the music business, to stay on pitch, especially, you know, with a whole group like that singing harmony. That's a hard thing to do.
And actually, Amanda, when she was in the group, and part of the way the group sustains itself is not just like selling CDs and that kind of thing, but Amanda actually did arrangements.
Of
modern music, you know, pop songs, those kinds of things, and then
that's
arranging it
too.
For the group, and then but then they would sell those arrangements to, you know, swing choirs in high school and things like that. So
now that's enterprise. That's neat. That is neat.
Which is why I'm surprised that she didn't actually go into music in some respects. But I mean, if you're going to have a hobby,
well, I was just going to say, if that's an avocation. That's, you know, it's that's always something you can do for the rest of your life there. That's terrific.
Although I don't think she ever scored any music for my second bass voice. But, of course, in a 14-woman a cappella group, there wouldn't necessarily be.
Now, here's an idea. You, me, and two other friends of ours form a barbershop quartet. And now she can make some arrangements.
Yeah, those arrangements would be that we would be playing on Lower Wacker Drive.
We'll still be playing for everybody that has to go get their car after it's been towed.
Now, there's a good idea, right? We can and great background.
Having been there myself.
Yeah, well, great and great background harmony will be the recording of the whatever the hawk is to scare the pigeons out of the parking lot underneath here,
like the one we have here.
Yeah, exactly. That can be our background vocals too, but. But, Dan Ponce from Channel 9, he's big into the a cappella stuff.
They're good. Have you heard that group?
Yes, yes. But he was like one of the, I think, one of the members, founding members of Straight No Chaser.
Straight No Chaser, right.
In Indiana. And, but, yeah, and now he's got a group that he's helping go forward with. I'm sorry, I can't think of the name, but it's... They're really good. I mean, it's quite an enterprise too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how that kind of music has taken off. Well, I have to say I got a nice hoodie for my friend Charlie the asparagus guy. I don't know if you remember me talking about Charlie. Charlie's at Honey Bear Canning Company in Michigan, and I'm still wondering why they don't sell this in stores. They do a pickled asparagus. Okay.
And a pickled asparagus?
A pickled asparagus. And they have one kind. It's pickled with a jalapeno in it.
Hmm.
And this stuff it's like eating popcorn. because it retains its snap.
The asparagus itself.
Yeah. Know?
And that's the important thing.
It's outstanding. And it makes a nice little like stirrer for your morning Bloody Mary. But Charlie came out with a new kind, and it's called, he calls them fire sticks. And the jalapeno has a little bit of heat to it, but let me tell you, the fire sticks, you don't need any Tabasco sauce or anything with those things. And you cannot eat those like popcorn. That will literally bring you to tears.
So
Charlie got me a nice hoodie, so I'm wearing it in his honor today. And Charlie and everybody, all the folks at Honey Bear Canning up in Michigan, thank you so much. And he's inviting us to come up and do a show up there one of these days.
Why not?
I'm for it.
Why not?
I mean, if we can, you know, get the WGN fan van gassed up and take it on the road.
I saw it standing by when I came in this morning.
Or we could take the newsroom Zamboni up there. It might be a little longer ride, but and given that weather forecast, it looks like you're going to have the Zamboni out there.
Yeah, that's right. We will have it at some point here, especially tomorrow, looking at some freezing rain and sleet, especially in the morning hours, of course. Also, rain into Tuesday, some rain and snow possible as well. Really starting to get into some winter weather now. Later in the week, highs only in the 20s for Thursday and New Year's Day. So it's going to finally, winter is,
We're due.
We're due.
I mean, not that I like it any better, but we're due. And I was out on the WGN Storm Center patio just a few minutes ago, and at least the rain has stopped, at least temporarily, here in downtown Chicago. So, but it is kind of still... it still has that drizzle feel to it out there.
The real hard-hitting weather, of course, is now in the south-southwest.
Yeah.
These terrible storms in Texas. 8 people killed in Texas, 25 storm-related deaths in 5 states just in the past few days.
And as you talked about our weather coming forward, too, I noticed on the future map, too, that the tornado threat will still exist in the south and
right.
Heading into the southeast.
Right, into the Texas and Oklahoma area.
Yeah, I mean, crazy, crazy weather. But fortunately...
It sounds like April and May rather than the end
exactly.
of December.
You don't think of... I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we got thunder snow here coming. I mean, well, really.
Like we did a few years ago
exactly.
during the blizzard.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's hope we don't get the blizzard.
But, exactly.
But, yeah, we are supposed to get some pretty strong winds as part of this storm moving in.
That's correct. So. Gusty winds, 35, maybe 40 miles an hour. Tomorrow, maybe gusts up to 50.
Wow. Wow.
So take care out there.
What a great way to start the week. And for maybe for a lot of people, you still might have some time off here. And so as we keep going with the holidays. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on the news, weather, and traffic. Producer Jasmine is fielding your phone calls, and you can reach us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin and on Twitter @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is here looking for the corkscrew for the New Year's champagne here at the Mighty 720. Just a reminder, you can also find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com along with all of our past shows. And you can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching Rick Pearson. Well, coming up, as I said, we've got a special show today, a year in review and a 2016 look ahead show coming up. That'll come up after Dave brings us the 7:30 news, and we'll be joined by WTTW Chicago Tonight political correspondent Paris Schutz, my recently retired Tribune colleague Bob Sector, and Christopher Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And we'll kind of break the show down into 3 half-hour parts of city, the state, and the nation. And of course, we'll welcome your phone calls and what you think may have been some of the top stories of the past year, as well as what you might see for a look ahead. That will be coming up after we take our weekly spin through national politics. But first, we're going to take a break. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio on a kind of drizzly Michigan Avenue this morning. It's time for our spin through national political news, and even though it was a holiday week, there was still some news. The decision by South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who's kind of running stagnant in the polls, he dropped out of the GOP presidential race, and of course there may be others soon to drop out ahead as we're less than 40 days to Iowa caucus day on February 1st. One thing that didn't stop on the holiday week was the slew of advertising that's playing in the early states of Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, and Nevada. And I thought I'd give you a sample of some of that this morning. And truly, much of this is being done by super PACs that are assisting the candidates rather than the candidates' campaigns themselves. And first off, Texas Senator Ted Cruz's super PAC says Cruz is a man who can be trusted.
You know, everyone here talks about the need to take on Washington. The natural next question is who actually has done so.
He really represents the people. He represents me.
He actually went to Washington, D.C. and did what he told the voters he was going to do.
Who actually has stood up not just to Democrats, but to leaders in our own party.
He's not afraid to say the honest truth, even from the Senate floor, even if it's unpopular.
When millions of Americans rose up against Obamacare, I was proud to lead that fight.
Sticks to his guns, doesn't apologize for what he has to say.
He has been consistent on every issue.
When millions of Americans rose up against Planned Parenthood, I was proud to lead that fight.
I feel as though he is a man of conviction.
Why do I support Ted Cruz? It's because I trust Ted Cruz.
Trust is everything.
We have to get it right.
I think he's what this country needs.
When I tell you I'm going to do something, I'm going to do exactly what I said I would do.
That's from the Ted Cruz super PAC. Florida Senator Marco Rubio's super PAC touts Rubio's conservative credentials in trying to kill Obamacare.
On Obamacare, some Republicans gave up.
Some talk tough, but got nowhere. For all the Republican talk about dismantling the Affordable Care Act, one Republican presidential hopeful has actually done something. Marco Rubio. Rubio conceived and pushed a plan that will all but kill Obamacare. Marco Rubio. Conservative. Smart. Results. No wonder he's the one Hillary's afraid to run against.
That's from the Marco Rubio super PAC. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul's campaign is taking issue with Rubio's poor Senate voting record while Rubio is running for president. I don't know if you remember the show, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, kids show on PBS. Well, here's Rand Paul's version in a new ad, and I got to tell you, I don't think it's very good.
You keep missing votes on the Senate floor, 43%. Of the votes. I know you say you're campaigning for president.
Marco Rubio.
A lot of these votes won't mean anything. They're not going to pass, and even if they did, the president would veto it.
The other day, though, you got up on the Senate floor and you said federal workers who don't show up should be fired.
Marco Rubio.
The Florida Sun Sentinel today, a newspaper that endorsed your colleague Marco Rubio for Senate back in 2010, called on Senator Rubio to resign because he's missing so many votes. They wrote, quote, "You are paid $174,000 per year to represent us, to fight for us, to solve our problems. You are ripping us off, Senator."
Marco Rubio.
Almost sounds like a guy in a phone booth somewhere, Marco Rubio. Meanwhile, a struggling former Florida Governor Jeb Bush's campaign launched an ad noting that in the last Republican debate, Bush was the only one to go after frontrunner Donald Trump.
Do you like Vladimir Putin's comments about you?
Sure.
I'm greatly honored by his statement. I think it's terrific.
You know, one of the things that you didn't take an opportunity to do last night was to really go after Donald Trump.
Again, he killed journalists that don't agree with him.
Well, I think our country does plenty of killing also, Joe.
So having known Donald Trump for 13 years, now he looks like a serious candidate to me.
This is an un-Republican thing for me to say.
Universal health care.
I am going to take care of everybody.
Senator Cruz, you have not been willing to attack Mr. Trump in public. But you did question his judgment.
I salute Donald Trump.
And listen, I commend Donald Trump.
Jeb Bush quickly denounced Trump, tweeting, quote, "A true freedom-loving conservative wouldn't be flattered by praise from a despot like Putin."
Where only Jeb Bush really challenged him.
He seemed like he was the only one willing to take on Donald Trump.
And certainly, he was the most aggressive in doing so.
Jeb Bush was the only one who tried to go after Donald Trump.
Kind of an interesting strategy. We'll see if that moves Jeb Bush anywhere in the polls. And as of course, there is Donald Trump. And the Donald used a bizarre term to describe Hillary Clinton's loss to Barack Obama in the 2008 Democratic presidential nominating contest. And then Trump even went after her for going to the bathroom during a break in the last Democratic debate.
Even a race to Obama, she was going to beat Obama. I don't know who'd be worse. I don't know. How does it get worse? But she was going to beat, she was favored to win, and she got lost. I mean, she lost. I'm watching the debate, and she disappeared. Where did she go? Where did she go? I know where she went. It's disgusting. I don't want to talk about it. No, it's too disgusting. Don't say it. It's disgusting.
Yeah, there's more of the Donald. That's your front runner in the Iowa caucus race so far. Still about a month to go, and things can change. We're going to take a break. I'm Rick Pearson. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be talking with Paris Schutz, political correspondent for WTTW's Chicago Tonight. Bob Sector, my recently retired colleague from the Chicago Tribune, and Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And we're going to start our roundtable taking a look at the year that was 2015 in politics. In the next half hour, we'll be focusing on what's been going on in the city and, of course, No shortage of things to talk about there.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase studio, where I'm joined by Paris Schutz, political correspondent for WTTW's Chicago Tonight. Paris, good morning. Thank you for getting up with me.
Good evening, good morning, whatever it is right now.
Well, but it's
no, it's the light's coming up over Michigan Avenue.
It's lightening up here, and the days are going to get longer.
We are on the right side.
We turned that corner now, even though the weather doesn't sound great coming up ahead. It actually is beautiful down here in the Showcase Studio to be able to see the day begin, see the week begin, really, in essence. Also here in the Allstate Showcase Studio is my good buddy Christopher Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Chris, good morning.
Morning, Rick.
Hope you got enough coffee going here.
Plenty of that.
And also on the phone from California, because he's retired and has nothing else to do, is my former Chicago Tribune colleague, Bob Sector. Bob, good morning.
Good morning.
How's the weather out in California?
It's actually, at this moment, it's colder than it is in Chicago.
Really?
And I'm in San Diego, so go figure that.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's going to change here. I don't think you've got sleet in the forecast anytime soon.
No. Just smog.
Sleet or freezing rain or any of that kind of thing.
Well, nothing like that at all.
Well, I hope your trip is going well. And happy holidays to all of you.
You as well.
Thank you.
I wanted to do the show in kind of three parts and spend a half hour looking at this first half hour looking at 2015 and 2016 as far as the city and city politics. And, you know, there's no shortage of things to talk about in the city. And, of course, let's go back to April, and we had the reelection of Rahm Emanuel in the city's first ever mayoral runoff election against Commissioner Jesus Chuy Garcia. And I wanted to play a cut from Rahm Emanuel's inaugural address from May 18th with Anita Alvarez sitting behind in the background, Bill Clinton, and others looking on.
This is our challenge as a city. No longer can we tolerate leaving so many young lives behind. Now, I do not pretend to have all the answers. The solution, though, does start with each of us. Over the next 4 years, I will do everything in my power to spark the hope in the eyes of every Chicagoan. We will keep increasing wages and attracting more jobs. We will continue to work to make our streets safer, our schools stronger, and provide more opportunities for our families. We will work harder than ever to restore trust where it is broken and opportunity where it is lost. But today I challenge every citizen of this great city. You must do your part. Be a role model for the young people in your life. Share the values that made you who you are with someone who wants to grow up just like you.
Those are the words of Rahm Emanuel in his reelection inaugural address on May 18th. And you listen to those words and, you know, and Chris, you know this better than anybody about inaugural addresses are meant to kind of set a tone. And you listen to that and then you look here at just months later, even, you know, yesterday, Chicago police fatally shooting two people, one a teen who was a bat, had a metal bat, and obviously was the apparent threat, but then also a neighbor. And I understand that the neighbor is going to be, their family is going to be having a press conference later today. But you're seeing, I think, a mayor under siege here.
Yeah, and in that speech, you heard a lot of sort of vague statements and hopeful statements, but you heard nothing about the police department. You heard nothing about a culture of silence or a code of silence, which the mayor now acknowledges exists and is rampant. So it's interesting that the Laquan McDonald case sort of forced this issue of the police department, which has been an issue for decades.
I was going to say, a decades-long issue.
But it actually forced the mayor to actually get out in front of it and talk about it and be the face of it. But like you said in that speech, nothing about property taxes going up $600 million. Nothing about – he did mention that the finances – we all knew how bad the pension situation was and the finances were. But, you know, we thought that runoff was the biggest story of the year at that point. And then – geez, look what happened. I mean, 2015 truly was the year that everything came home to roost in the city of Chicago. All these problems that had been festering for years and decades, this is the year that the dam broke.
Well, and, you know, a lot of Emanuel's election, his first election, the re-election, was his attempt to, especially in the re-election, for example, portraying himself as like the only adult in the room.
Right.
And that the only guy equipped to handle the city's problems,
right.
But also from the first election, here's the guy I was elected to make the hard decisions.
And he put off, I mean, it's fair that he inherited a police culture that's been decades, you know, had problems for decades. He inherited finances that had gone just down into the tank. But you can say that in his first 4 years, you know, he didn't raise property taxes, and perhaps he should have. He didn't do enough to stop the borrowing and the debt that was building up. And he didn't address the police situation in his first 4 years. So you can't just say this is all inherited chickens coming home to roost. It's his problem, too, that he didn't solve in his first 4 years.
Chris, does a guy like Emanuel who – and I was talking to somebody about this the other day, too, about his success has always largely been as – Not being the front guy, and now he's the front guy, and I mean, does he survive?
Well, you know, he is the quintessential chief of staff. He's also the quintessential SOB, right? Which is what it takes to be a good chief of staff, and whether that translates into general love, sort of daddy figure that we have for executive leadership in this country, you know, that remains an open question. It's not working well for him. I don't think people like him very much, but that's not necessary. I don't know that all people, you know, Richie Daley liked him all that much either, but they feared him. They fear Rahm on a sort of personal level, but I don't know if he has, you don't feel like he's got his fingers on all the levers of power that that Daley did, and it's almost like a one-man show. He cares personally about, and I don't know if he wants to be loved or not. I don't want to get inside of the guy's head, but he does want to be the big man, right? And you know, we're all engaged, and I don't think, you know, we're all engaged in, or not all of us, but a lot of people are engaged in a lot of schadenfreude of this year because, you know, hey, got forced in the runoff. That was kind of cool. I mean, people saw him with a little comeuppance, a little shame, had a sweater on. You know, and this is after we watched that CNN special where he kind of posed as Batman, and we're all going, what the hell? You know, and now this thing with Laquan McDonald, I mean, this is something that's been going on forever, and we just now see it on TV. And it's just like with the Vietnam War. When we saw it, when Tet happened and we saw those guys in the embassy grounds, that changed things, and it changed things forever. This has changed things forever. Does he survive it? I don't know. We're not going to be able to get him. I mean, he's not going to be able to be pushed out for the next 3 years. That's just not going to happen. But unless he decides to go himself, it gets too hot. I don't know.
Bob, he never was a guy. I think I even said on one of the TV shows about how Rahm Emanuel never got elected on a likability quotient. Mm-mm. But I mean, when he shows or tries to show empathy, people don't get that.
Yeah. Yeah. With this Laquan McDonald situation, I think it shows that there's a sort of boy who cried wolf phenomenon going on here. Here's a guy, he may be absolutely telling the truth, that this is all a coincidence and that the settlement occurred a week after after he was reelected, and it had nothing to do with politics, and it was just, you know, it just happened to be the timing of it. But the problem he has is that it's entirely believable with his character that he would do such a thing. And I think I said on your show the last time I was on that he has a real sincerity deficit. and it's finally coming home to roost. You look at the election. You know, as you said, he portrayed himself as the only adult in the room. But he kept on saying that Chuy Garcia didn't have a plan for anything, and he had a plan. Well, his plan was apparently to jack up taxes tremendously and somehow hope that Springfield would bail him out, which, frankly, Chuy Garcia could have done that. So he's a guy who just has a hard time connecting with people and having people believe that he's sincere because he so often isn't.
Well, a reputation for calculation, and now he's becoming perhaps a victim of that reputation.
Yeah, it's the chickens are coming home to roost on that. Whether or not he did plan this, the timing of the settlement.
Right. Right.
Well, and you've had lawyers for the family saying, no, I mean, the timeline is correct. I mean, that was the timeline. We did come to them in, what was it, February, that we first came to them with our demands. So it's plausible. It's also plausible that perhaps they kept fighting the Freedom of Information request to get this video released because they didn't want to see riots. They didn't want to see what happened in Baltimore or Ferguson, that would be a national embarrassment for Chicago and also could threaten public safety. And the irony is, once the video got released and everyone's waiting to see what happens, is the city going to explode? The protests were peaceful.
Right, right, right. We're speaking with Paris Schutz, political correspondent from WTTW Chicago Tonight, Bob Sechter, my former colleague at the Chicago Tribune, and Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Early Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio at Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue, and we're doing our 2015 Year in Review, 2016 Look Ahead show with Paris Schutz, the political correspondent from WTTW Chicago Tonight, Bob Sechter, my now retired colleague from the Chicago Tribune, and Christopher Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. We've got a call from Ron. Ron, Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, Rick, and just a great show all year. My question to your guest is, these events involving the Chicago Police Department, I wanted to ask them, could there possibly be any political ramifications for the national elections? We know that there is a relationship between Rahm and Hillary Clinton, and most of these events are occurring in the African-American community, which, as we know, makes up a large percentage of the Democrat voters. So that's my thing, and it's not only been looked at locally, but pretty much nationally. So I wanted to ask them, do they think there may be, and with this investigation from the Department of Justice probably going into next year, do they think there probably could be some political ramifications? So, thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Ron. And indeed, Bernie Sanders was in town last week, was talking about the issue of policing, criminal justice matters. I noted he had what was supposed to be a press conference, but spoke for 19 minutes and then took two questions from one reporter and left. But one of the questions was, you know, given Rahm's stature in the Democratic Party and, you know, should you become the Democratic nominee, do you want Rahm Emanuel's help? And his answer was, with all due respect to the mayor, I don't want it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like if Hillary Clinton needs the left, you know, she needs to really get their support. The left doesn't like Rahm Emanuel. The left wing of the Democratic Party, the more progressive wing, she might have to distance herself from Rahm. And she called for a Justice Department investigation, but she stopped short of calling for him to step down. So politics is reactive. If this investigation gets really bad and Rahm Emanuel – and it goes up to the fifth floor and Rahm Emanuel, somehow there's some smoking gun and he looks really bad, yeah, it will. And Hillary Clinton will be forced to make a choice of sort of breaking from – I wouldn't say a longtime friend, but someone, you know, who's an ally in the Democratic establishment, and it will. But if this sort of tends to die down nationally, which I think it started, then I don't think it will have ramifications nationally.
Yeah, I don't think Hillary would have any problem throwing Rahm out of the bus at any moment.
Right.
That's not an issue. I think you have to look at both the primary and the general, right? Because elections are all about against who, not just in the abstract. And in the case of the primary, I don't think it's going to hurt him in the primary. Bernie Sanders' biggest fear is that he wins the nomination. So that if that danger starts happening, he'll do something to shoot himself in the foot. But in the general, the Democrats, if they're going to win next November, they're going to need to really motivate and mobilize not only the African-American community, but the Latino community and all various communities that are not white, middle-aged, and, pissed off and voting for Donald Trump. So if she's running against Cruz, if she's running against Trump, if she's running against Rubio, her strategy has to be, number one, to shore up that base and get them excited. And this might, it's not just, it's just the Quam McDonald. This is happening everywhere in the country. We're just waiting. It's like terrorism. We're just waiting for the next one to happen. And if she can get on the front end of this, then she might be able to mobilize those people. But on the other hand, then she risks, just as Rahm does, you risk alienating either the right wing in general and certainly the police in particular. So,
Bob Sector,
let me second that. I mean, the greatest mobilization tool that Hillary or Bernie Sanders or whoever gets the nomination has for mobilizing minority voters, progressive voters, is the Republican nominee. And so far, it looks like, if it's nominee Trump or nominee Cruz, it's going to be, I think, fairly easy for Hillary or whoever to rev up those voters who are probably appalled by what they're hearing from the Republican side of the aisle at the moment. Now, if it's somebody else, if it's a Rubio, maybe that equation changes a little bit.
But, well, we'll focus on those dynamics on the presidential later in the show. But real quickly, before we close out talking about the city, we've got the Chicago teachers taking a strike vote. We have CPS trying to argue that vote isn't legitimate. But look at everything that's going on in the city. What happens if the teachers go on strike?
Well, speaking of all the chickens coming home to roost, I mean, we didn't mention the Chicago Public Schools, years and years and years of fiscal mismanagement, and the dam is broke there, and they need $500 million from Governor Rauner from the state, which doesn't seem like – and it seems like Speaker Madigan is holding that up. It's interesting. I think the mayor has lost a lot of political leverage, and the teachers union kind of, like sharks going after chum. They see a real opportunity to really get a lot of concessions out of him, even though public schools have no money. They're broke. Where are they going to find the money to give the teachers what they want? But Rahm is so politically weakened that they're like, this is the best time to strike.
But even as politically weakened in the perception when it comes to the city council, it's still the city council, and while there's opportunity among, let's say, the progressive caucus and some of the usual critics, by and large, the council is still going to be supportive of the mayor.
The biggest surprise has been the African American caucus. I mean, their communities are livid with the mayor, and yet they are still taking a wait and see approach in terms of whether they abandon him or stick around, and so far their comments are very tepid. They're still sticking with the guy. So you haven't seen that political dynamic change yet, and perhaps he won't be weakened politically in the end.
Plus, I also think too, and I don't mean to get inside Rahm's head either, but I mean, Chris, politics is short attention span theater.
Well, you're thinking that maybe he's going to throw this up and look over here, don't look at this other hand, and now we have a strike and I can be the leader.
Well, and plus he's got 3.5 years to go, too.
Right.
So, and he's not going to go anywhere.
Right.
So,
and the other thing is, you know, he has the whole police reform thing out of his hands. It's almost like the Justice Department coming in is the best thing that could have happened to him, because they can come in and make these big reforms that progressives are going to like, but he doesn't have to draw the ire of the police union, the FOP, or cops in general. Well, hey, they said I have to do it. I didn't do it. So it's like the best of both worlds. He doesn't get hurt politically from that.
Although Annie Sweeney, my colleague at the Tribune, who's kind of covered some of these consent decrees and other in other cities where the DOJ came in on these police cases, the experts say, don't wait for the DOJ.
Sure. And he's trying to get out ahead of that with this task force, which
is a task
knows?
Force.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. The age-old.
It's a blue ribbon task force.
Right.
So it's going to be good this time.
You know it's got to be good.
Right.
Chris Mooney, Paris Schutz, Bob Sector joining me here as we do our 2015 Year in Review show. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and this is your Sunday Spin. It was just outside of Michigan Avenue, and yeah, it's going to be cloudy and somewhat dreary, but I have to say it's pretty temperate out there for this Sunday after Christmas, the last Sunday of 2015. And that's the important point, because this is a special Sunday Spin. We're taking a look at 2015, the year that was, as well as a look ahead into the new year of 2016. And joining me in our roundtable is Paris Schutz. He's the political correspondent on WTTW Chicago Tonight. Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. They're here with me in the Allstate Showcase studio. And on the phone is Bob Sector, a recently retired member of our political team at the Chicago Tribune. And for this half hour, I wanted to kind of move along to state politics and the year that was. And this also kind of ties into our last conversation on some of the financial issues dealing with the city. But first, let's go back to January of 2015, January 15th, 2015, when Bruce Rauner is sworn in as Illinois governor.
We are in the midst of a government financial crisis that has been building for decades. Its roots lie in bad decisions, bad practices, and bad management by state government. It is not a partisan creation. It is a truly bipartisan one. Our government has spent more than we could afford, borrowed money, and called it revenue. Rather than responsibly budgeting the money we had, we implemented programs we couldn't afford. In the face of a declining economy, we raised taxes. This hurt our economy even more, put more stress on our social safety net, and pushed more Illinoisans out of our state, leaving fewer taxpayers to support the government. As a result, today, Illinois is not as competitive as we need to be, and we cannot be as compassionate as we want to be.
That's Governor Bruce Rauner from his inaugural address on January 15th. So here is the Republican governor, the guy who promised to shake up Springfield. And a year later, virtually, what progress have we made?
Well, it's funny listening to that. The only difference now is the finances are worse than when he made that speech. And I think, you know, it's safe to say he made a pretty obvious political miscalculation, and we talked about this, Rick, in the beginning of the year. The first thing he does is he starts to barnstorm the state, talking about right to work, talking about, you know, his union weakening agenda, instead of just going right to work and focusing on the budget and not realizing you have super majority of Democrats, and what's happened is what we kind of thought would happen is you've coalesced labor, which already has a lot of power, behind Mike Madigan, who wasn't that big a friend of labor before that because he supported pension reform. Now you've coalesced them behind the Democrats and Mike Madigan, who've become completely intransigent. And so you have this deadlock. But I have to say, it's not as if Democrats have put forth their own agenda. All they've done is block the governor's agenda because that looks good politically for them. But they don't have to take any tough votes either. And so we have this horrible problem. Instead of the governor, you know, maybe not being so loud about his agenda, whether you agree with it or not, and taking 8 years here. I have an 8-year plan to enact this agenda rather than just going all out right in the beginning and coalescing the opposition.
Well, what about that, Chris? Because, I mean, one of the things that he had stated, you know, on a political agenda was the fact that, you know, he wanted to do his best to try to get Republican legislative majorities by, you know, his two terms in office. Sure. Should he seek re-election?
Well, you know, it's tough to fight demographics, and it's almost as tough as fighting redistricting. And those two things work against the Republicans of this state. There just aren't that many Republicans. Even if the Republicans were able to cut the map these days, the way demographics are shifting in this state and have shifted for the last 20 years, there's just not enough to make that happen. So, and you know, no matter how rich you are, those are things you can't fight. And but he's doing his best. I think Paris hit the nail on the head, and I think that the fact that he came out with this anti-union agenda item that, you know, where was that in the general election? He didn't talk about that at all. Yeah. And so all of a sudden, oh, he's turning into this. He said, I'm not ideological. He went and made a point. I'm not, you know, but I'm here to fix things. Well, that's not what he's done. And by putting that as the sticking point, not only has he coalesced the unions around Mike Madigan, which I agree is really surprising that that's happened, especially AFSCME, who do not like sure. him much because of what some of the things that he's done over the years. But it's also the case that it just makes it more difficult because he's given the Democrats the cover to say no. And you know, if he wanted to fix the problem, he would have kept that the anti-union stuff off the agenda, and he would have not taken away all the pressure points early on in this process. The typical way this happens is that the chief executive makes it into a crisis. No, there, you know, the crises don't exist in the abstract. You have to say this is a crisis. Somebody's got to say it, right? And whether it's in the street, somebody's getting beat up, or a car, or whatever it is, somebody says, "Oh, now it's a crisis," and then we all say, "Oh, this is a crisis." And what that's the way that's done is you close the state parks over the 4th of July weekend. You refuse to pay the salaries of the state workers come the 15th of July. Then people say, what? Oh, right. We can't stop. Instead, he takes all the, you know, he signs the K-12 bill, so schools open in August, and it's just these little, it's a death by a thousand cuts, to use a cliche, where little daycare providers are going out of business. You know, women's shelters are not being able to take, you know, battered women in. And that is not a huge, it's a crisis on the individual level for sure, but it's not the kind of crisis that gets into the headlines, and that's what you need to resolve this thing. And he has systematically gotten rid of that, and that was a tactical error for sure on his part.
Bob, you and I have talked about this obviously the entire past year, but one point as far as the politics of it is that I think you have Bruce Rauner thinks he's winning in the public mind. And Mike Madigan thinks that Democrats are winning in the public mind.
Yeah, and so the reality is everybody's losing. Rauner's got, I mean, I think Chris hit it on the head. Rauner is the thing he's accomplished the most in this past year is making Mike Madigan into a somewhat sympathetic character, which is a really hard thing to do.
Kind of like Rod Blagojevich and Dick Mell.
Exactly.
Right. And, you know, Rauner came during the campaign, you know, he kept on campaigning, talking about how, you know, the phrase that always sticks in my mind, I've been studying with Scott Walker. He's trying to implement what happened in Wisconsin under Scott Walker into Illinois, but he doesn't have the votes like Scott Walker did. And so he's using the leverage he has, which is basically to say no, but it's not working. And so, you know, everything's a big mess right now. And if you look up in Wisconsin, financially, that's not working either. None of the things that Scott Walker promised when he he had his anti-union agenda have actually come to pass. The state budget up there is not very good, and Walker's popularity has nosedived, as has Warner's, very quickly.
We're speaking with Bob Sector from a recently retired member of the Chicago Tribune's political team, Paris Schutz from WTTW, and Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is our year-in-review show on the Sunday Spin. Don't adjust your TV sets. This is,
I thought we were going to get a little more intellectual here.
This is the Sunday Spin, and Paris Schutz, the political correspondent for WTTW Chicago Tonight, is here. And, of course, Paris also wrote the theme song and played on this. We had a text asking whether that was real musicians or was that all electronic.
Well, thank you so much for the text. I always love it when people respond to the theme song. That's all real music. I'm a piano player and writer and composer, and we wanted a new theme song, and I sat down at the piano and I just kind of whistled a very, very simple melody, da 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 da, and basically it's Chicago Tonight, Chicago Tonight, and so we played it on the piano, and I brought in a friend of the show, John Hagstrom, who is the second chair trumpet player at the CSO, and he's all the horns that you hear on there. He had about five different horns that he put on there. So it's piano and trumpet, and that's it. And the rest is just pretty nice production, but there's nothing electronic on there. It's all real.
And now we know that there are actually words to the song.
Chicago Tonight. Yes, my inner Bob Dylan. Very, very deep lyrics.
Well,
thank you so much, though. I really appreciate the acknowledgement.
Paris is here with us in the Allstate Showcase studio, as is Christopher Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And on the phone, my former Tribune colleague, former seatmate at the Tree of Knowledge outside Tribune Tower, Bob Sector. And we're talking, as we do our week or year in review show, we're talking about the issues of Springfield and the state of Illinois. But there is, and we got into this in the past half hour when we were talking about the city, a lot of the financial issues that the city is looking for help for are rely on Springfield. And I've always scratched my head about that, because when you look at the state's inability to deal with its financial issues, look for the city to look at, and I think that the tag is pretty close to $1 billion worth of various cash and cash relief for the schools, CTA, for the city. You know, Bob, I think here maybe, and Bruce Rauner thinks, is a pressure point.
Oh, he definitely does. I mean, you know, it may be, but part of it is we're in the blame game right now. And, you know, if Rauner thinks that he's, you know, Emanuel's going to look bad and Mike Madigan's going to have to cave because the city of Chicago is in chaos, Mike Madigan is the most calculating politician in America, I would guess, except maybe for Rahm Emanuel. And,
but he's better at it.
Yeah,
right. And, you know, so in the end, if there is chaos, you know, who's going to wear the jacket for it? And they're both betting that it's Bruce Rauner. Now, there may be hundreds of thousands of kids who and, you know, tens of thousands of teachers who really, you know, really suffer because of this. But you know, these guys think in terms of who can they pin the blame on rather than more than anything else.
It's all politics. I mean, it's all about the 2016 races, especially for Speaker Madigan. I personally don't think he lays awake at night. I don't know that for a fact. Worrying about what's going to happen to the poor kids. It's worrying about what's going to happen in 2016. How do I shield my members from tough votes so I can keep my power? And the interesting thing with the CPS, Chicago Public Schools, needs $500 million. And Rahm Emanuel basically got Bruce Rauner and John Cullerton to agree in principle to help bail out the public school pensions and help give some cash relief. But who's holding it up? Speaker Madigan, who doesn't agree. And I think part of that is because the mayor went kind of to Bruce Rauner and John Cullerton to try to negotiate this fix, but not to the speaker. And so the speaker says, well, I don't agree with this bill. And the stated reason is because he worries about in the future it could mean less funding for CPS overall as they change the school formula. So it's all caught up in a political football. It doesn't matter how dire the situation is in Chicago. It still all comes down to the politics.
You know, it's also the case that, you know, there's no doubt it's this is a political issue. I mean, you know, there's no doubt about that. But the speaker knows public policy in this state more deeply than probably anybody else in the state. He's been around a long time. He really understands the ins and outs of proposals that are put forward. He understands and cares deeply and undoubtedly more deeply than anybody else about the place of the legislature in our system of government. And you know, and this is not necessarily self-aggrandizement or a power grab on his part, but he understands that in the American form of government, one of the geniuses of our form of government is the balance of power among the three branches. And the legislature has no army. It's got no executive. It's got very few staff. The only thing they have is control of the legislation, and especially control of the power of the purse, which we've had in our system of government for 800 years since, you know, the barons forced King John on the fields of Runnymede to give up the power of the purse. And that has completely gone out the window. And I can just imagine that this is just driving him crazy right now, because the budget is run. The executive branch is driving. The judicial branch is driving. The legislature is cut out, and he's not going to stand for that.
Well, let's look ahead to 2016. And, of course, we have the entire Illinois House of Representatives is up for election. We've got a great number, dozens of seats in the Illinois Senate. How do you think this plays out with voters? Obviously, Democrats have the advantage of the map, of the boundary lines in the state, of the demographics. But certainly, everybody's kind of waiting for Bruce Rauner and his money to weigh in, the aligned super PACs that he has, plus his own wallet where he's promised to help helpful Republicans. How do you see this playing out?
Well, the Democrats are heavily exposed right now and have been. They have been very successful. So that means they've won almost all of the marginal seats. And that's where politics rides, is on the margins, right? Where, you know, the Republicans are not going to win the legislature by getting 95% vote in the Senate district in Effingham or something like that. It's right. Going to be in Kankakee. It's going to be in the suburbs where the Democrats are winning. By very, you know, the state representative from Kankakee, Kate Cloonan, has won by the last two elections by, I think, a total of 85 votes. You know, that's, you know, that could be threatened. You know, that's random, right? Mm-hmm. How many people had a flat tire on the way to the polls? But the Democrats have consistently won those. But, you know, they could lose all of those marginal seats, and they're still going to keep the majority. Can Rauner come in there? I mean, for him, $1 million is nothing. You know, he and his six poker buddies, they'll just pull out one of the pots and they'll throw that in, and they'll be able to, you know, bankroll a dozen state legislative races for $1 million apiece. That wouldn't be significant. So what? They win them all. They're still not going to get the majority.
And so for you,
go ahead, Bob.
No, I just think the dynamic, you know, in theory, Madigan has a veto-proof majority, but as we've seen in the last several months, you know, all it takes is one or two people to pick off, and that doesn't work anymore. So what's going to happen in 2016, in terms of numbers, he has the greatest he's ever had, and that's likely to diminish somewhat after the elections. But the situation is going to end up being pretty much the same as it is right now, with as a standoff. There's not really a veto-proof majority, and Madigan's still going to be in charge after November 2016, as is Cullerton, and yet they can't just run the table on Rauner.
In some sense, he'll be stronger. The irony is, when you've got a smaller majority, the leader is stronger, because the people who are in the caucus are more solidly in that party, and they all know that they've got to stick together. you know, you get your Ken Duncans of the world. He's got so much power by being the one guy who can say no and change everything. And this is a state representative. Actually, we're probably sitting in his district right now.
I believe we are. Yes.
Yeah, it runs from South Shore all the way up to Old Town. And he can, and this is his one moment of glory.
Right. Or Jack Franks from Marengo. Mm-hmm. I mean, just imagine the power you have. It's like, well, Governor Rauner, show me, give me your best shot. Well, Speaker Madigan, give me your best shot. It's almost as if, like you said, the speaker, it's a bigger headache having a supermajority, mm-hmm. because everyone's like, well, you got a supermajority. Why can't you just do what you want? Well, he can't, and he has to fight this narrative that he's the most powerful man in Springfield because he's got all the numbers and he can't marshal all of them. So in a way, that's a headache for him.
It's a good time to be a free agent in Mike Madigan's caucus.
Right. And if they get down to sort of, instead of having, you know, 71 votes, they get down to having, you know, 65 or 60, he's in a much better position.
And he likes getting Republicans on votes. I mean, he likes making it a bipartisan across the aisle vote. That's where he makes his money. That's his bread and butter.
We're speaking about the state of the state for 2015 and 2016 and our year in review. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning, the last Sunday of 2015. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. Joined by Paris Schutz, political correspondent of WTTW Chicago Tonight. Bob Sector is on the phone from California, and Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, also here in studio. At the onset of the show, we were talking about a cappella music and Dan Ponce, and it's Gentleman's Rule is the group right. that he's producing now, and they're taking off. I mean, it's I guess there's something about a cappella music. You just, you know, it gets you rolling.
Well,
yeah, it does.
Dan Ponce, also a great soap opera, Spanish telenovela
yes,
performer.
which seems to be a co-production with Channel 11 with all of the props that are given to Channel 11.
Phil had a little nice cameo in one of those. I'm still waiting for my call.
And the Channel 11 tote bag, too, was also prominently featured in
exactly.
that as well. Well, we're doing a special year in review show, a look ahead at 2016. And for this segment of the show, I want to move into national politics. And of course, the first in the nation Iowa caucus is less than 40 days away, coming up on February 1st. I wanted to play this cut. It's a relatively new Hillary Clinton ad that she's running in Iowa.
America is not just electing a president, we're also electing a commander-in-chief. That choice matters because strengthening the economy, making health care more affordable, raising incomes, all of that depends on us being both secure at home and leading the world. I will get up every single day and do whatever it takes to make sure our country is safe and strong.
Now, who could have guessed at the beginning of 2015 that the issue of national security, concern about the Islamic State, ISIS, would be kind of issues at the forefront as we move into the 2016 presidential election? And well, how do you think that plays with Hillary Clinton as a former Secretary of State?
Well, isn't it interesting that in 2008 we thought it was going to be foreign policy and then the economy crashed, and so it was all about the economy, and then everyone had to shift gears, and John McCain had run as the foreign policy hawk. I think the Republican front runners, it doesn't seem like foreign policy was their focus or their strong suit. It's interesting that Lindsey Graham never got any traction because that was his thing. But when you look at Rubio, Ted Cruz— Donald Trump, it's more about appealing to sort of the conservative working class and the economy. And so I think it does play to Hillary Clinton's strengths, although there's the trust factor problem that she has that she's going to have to overcome. I don't know. That's my view.
Well, Chris, I mean, how much of that part of the, you know, as we've seen the Republican campaign roll out, how much of that is just because it's been so dominated by Donald Trump kind of setting the agenda?
Well, you know, Donald Trump, regardless of what Time magazine says, definitely the man of the year. He and for good or ill, right? And he'll be the first one to tell you that's true. he has.
Putin thought so.
That's right. His old buddy Putin are going to go up do some curling together. He has, you know, in a way that's probably, I mean, Adolf Hitler was also the man of the year one year. We don't want to forget that. So, you know, it's a matter of changing things and having an impact. And he had an amazing impact. We look a year ago, if anybody would have said Trump would taken seriously by anybody, we'd think, well, maybe so. But Bush, it would look like a Bush-Clinton sort of race shaping up. Bush has completely imploded. Trump has ridden a wave and shows you something about the Republican Party. He's, you know, the demographics of his support are almost exactly the same demographics of Tea Party support. It's middle-aged, white, a high school education or less, most male, more than female, pissed off. They see America that used to be great when they were kids and there wasn't a lot of black people around. There wasn't a lot of brown people around. They think back when we dominated the world, but they forget about Vietnam, which was going on when these people were kids.
And the fact that the crime rate was much worse.
Crime rate,
you know,
was
in
worse.
Cities,
the economy
in the 70s
was
it is
worse.
Now.
That's right. Yeah. But it's a nostalgia in some sense for these people. There and they're a rump part of the Republican Party. The Republican Party understands that this, if they go that direction, they are going to go the way of the Whigs. But you know, when you have a big race, a lot of people, if you get 30%, you look like you're dominating. And so that's where we're at.
Bob, what do you think the Trump success so far, and I say so far, what does that say about the Republican Party and its future?
Well, they have a big problem. They're fighting demographics. And, the fact that Trump is running a race that appeals to people in the 1950s. And unfortunately, for the Republicans, anyway, the demographics are quite different. Chris just said a moment ago that, you know, there weren't a lot of black people around, in the old days. Well, there actually were, but
I'm talking about in their vision of their mind when they look back on what the childhood was like.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But, you know, all of a sudden you've got a bunch of white people who are confronted with the fact that their dominance in American society is on the wane. And they don't like that, which I guess is understandable to some extent. But, you know, the numbers are the numbers. And, you know, whether it's 2020 or 2030, the numbers are going to be overwhelming, for the kind of demographic that Democrats are now appealing to and that Republicans kind of hope they'd be appealing to, but haven't actually found the formula to do it yet.
Well, and you touched on what Republicans had hoped because, you know, you had that great autopsy that Reince Priebus and the RNC did of the last election, and it was all about reaching out and about, yes, we're going to have to do something on immigration. There was an acknowledgement on that, and that obviously we have to reach out as a party to the growing segments of the population. And then one of the first speeches, his announcement speech, and Trump is already throwing a brick on immigration, and we're going to send everybody that is undocumented out of the country because that self-deportation thing that Mitt Romney tried didn't work out so well. I mean, totally counter.
The irony is that it kind of is. I mean, the net flow from Mexico is actually going the other way now.
Right. Yeah. Well, you're touching on something that frankly, the most interesting phenomenon of this presidential election year is that I think that it points out that we have moved into a sort of post-factual society. It really doesn't matter what the facts are.
Right.
People just say stuff. And, Hillary Clinton does it with her the video comment that she had the other day. Trump is the master of it. And so it doesn't really matter what the facts are anymore.
I wonder if that coincides with, you know, newsrooms shrinking and journalism being on the way. And it's like candidates have figured out you can just kind of say what sounds good or what's going to appeal to people. And the whole, you know, lying thing, you know, who cares?
Yeah, absolutely.
As well as perhaps just an acceptance that politicians are going to lie anyway, so I might as well favor the guy that's telling the lies
I
want to hear.
Like, mm-hmm. The lie I want to hear. I wonder, yeah, Rick.
Lie to me, baby.
I wonder if it's stunning to me that even in Illinois there was a poll, I think in Politico, that showed Donald Trump was up 30% to 15%.
I wouldn't put a lot of
credence in that. Well, I mean, even in a more moderate state like Illinois, he's winning. And I'm wondering if you think that if this goes to the convention and he's still, you know, he's got the most delegates or whatever, if there's some kind of brokered convention where Paul Ryan, through some deal, becomes a nominee or something like that.
He's got to shave first, though.
Yeah, he's got to shave first.
Well, we'll talk about the conventions coming up. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue by Chris Mooney, Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, Paris Schutz, political correspondent on Chicago Tonight on WTTW, and on the phone, my recently retired Chicago Tribune colleague, Bob Sector. And we're doing a little year in review and what's ahead. And we were talking about, you know, what happens going into Cleveland for the Republican National Convention in 2016, and Donald Trump is in the mix. And of course, there had been some stories about Republicans talking about the potential of a brokered convention. And, you know, we've got the Illinois primary on March 15th. And Illinois that week marks, I believe, the first week in the Republican calendar that the nominating delegates aren't proportional to how they fare in a popular primary vote. And of course, in Illinois, delegates are elected separately, directly by the voters by congressional district, three delegates in each of the state's 18 districts. So there's a little bit of a difference there. And in talking to the Trump people that are here in Illinois, they're saying, well, we're not going to have any big name delegates, but we don't believe that's necessary because when you elect a delegate, the name of the candidate they're supporting appears behind in parentheses. Whereas, you know, you have Bush obviously was much better organized coming out of the blocks here in Illinois. The Kasich, John Kasich, Ohio governor, has a strong slate of supporters. Marco Rubio as well. And, you know, so many people predicted the demise of Donald Trump all along, and yet it's almost folly to even do so.
Well, I still predict it. I think the smart money is that he's not going to win the nomination. It takes a lot of organization. It takes, you know, what's going to happen when actual voters start weighing in on this, the field's going to start shrinking down. And, you know, I may well, and as is often the case, be proven wrong by actual events. I think Trump has got a third of the Republican Party, like a third of the Democratic Party, more or less, is on the fringe, right? That's, you know, Bernie Sanders. You're going to get people voting for Bernie Sanders because there's people over there on the left. You're just going to get people, and he's not purely a right wing, but he's got that kind of angry white right wing thing going on over there. And but, you know, you start losing people like the Kasich, you know, that things are going to coalesce around some of the candidates. Plus, I mean, you're going to see in Iowa, and again, predictions are always dangerous, but, you know, Cruz is the one who's going to win Iowa. I mean, right. Iowans in the caucus, it's the evangelicals that win, right? Because they're the ones that are organized. They got the preachers on Sunday saying, you got to get there on Tuesday. You know, who needs a ride? Well, you know, get this woman, pick her up and take her over. You know, Trump, that's just, you know, a diffuse anger, you know, and that doesn't really motivate people in the practice of politics. It might motivate them in the general election or in, you know, sort of a general primary where people go. But primaries, You know, it takes effort, more effort to go in the primary than it does in the general election to understand what's going on, understand
well, and particularly, as we've talked before on the program, particularly for a caucus because of the...
You bet.
This is not just going to the voting booth and leaving. This is something that can take a couple hours and really requires an extensive part of activism.
That's why Robertson wins. That's why Santorum wins in past years. So Cruz probably wins, and what does that do? That probably shrinks some things. People start coalescing towards him. Now, I don't think Cruz nomination is any better for the Republican Party than a Trump nomination. Trump is a wild card. Cruz, he's also not speaking to the future in some respects. So he's pulling them over to the right, and that's going to make it difficult for them in the long run.
Well, Bob Secker, I talked on the show about one poll that it was, and I believe it was on a national basis, not Iowa, but it was looking at Ted Cruz. And when it came to the question of who is the best candidate for president equipped to work with Congress, the plurality went to Ted Cruz.
Wow. Really?
Is that a public opinion poll?
Yes.
Well, what do they know?
Yeah. I think that goes back to what I said about a post-factual world. I mean, here's a guy whose Senate colleagues on both sides of the aisle would vote him. They can't agree on anything, but the one thing they can agree is they hate that guy.
Right.
He's just an unpleasant person. And I think what you're going to see as you go into 2016 is for both parties, there's going to be a narrow core of people who are very enthusiastic about certain candidates. But in general, there's going to be a lack of enthusiasm, because Hillary Clinton, it's Hillary Clinton, and she's been there, done that, and on the other side, a lot of Republicans are not going to be able to stomach a Trump or a Cruz. They might vote for them, but it's going to be a hold your nose vote. So that's the big question: is where do you generate the enthusiasm to actually go past the finish line in November?
And that, frankly, I think, Bob, is going to be the story of 2016. Is about where, if any, is the enthusiasm, or is there an enthusiasm deficit? Gentlemen, that's all we've got time for right now. I want to thank Paris Schutz, political correspondent for Chicago Tonight, WTTW.
Thank you.
Bob Secker, recently retired member of the political team at the Chicago Tribune, and Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests on our Year in Review Roundtable, and I also want to thank all of you for listening out there, and to you and to Dean Richards, a very, very happy new year.
Thank you. Same to you. Are you going to be down here for the big celebration? What's it called? Chi-Town Rising?
Yeah, Chi. What is with the Chi-Town
thing? Clearly somebody from out of town named it that.
Yeah, and then
I don't know anybody who lives here who calls this Chi-Town.
Plus, it was supposed to be, everything was supposed to be free and all of that, and now it's
it not now?
No, it's they're charging like $100 and some.
It's a big bargain to stand out in the middle of a crowd of a million people on a probably cold, wet night.
I just,
if you look out our window here in the Showcase Studio, I think that's the star
is it supposed to drop?
Is
or
it going
to
rise? Oh, I guess it would be rising if it's Chi-Town Rising.
I have no idea.
I guess it makes more sense to rise than drop.
Yeah, it's not a very tall building either.
What?
So is the countdown going to be 3, 2, 1, or how are they going to do that?
Once again, second city to New York. We don't have time for a full 10 count.
Right, right.
We have to get to business here. We've got things to do here in Chicago. We're going to talk to the guy who's produced all of this coming up in a little while, so I'll have more details than you could possibly imagine on this whole New Year's Eve thing down here on Wacker Drive coming up in a little while. We've got some of our year-ending things coming up in the world. Not that politics isn't entertaining, that's for sure.
Unfortunately.
The actual world of entertainment, there were some pretty big stories that we were lucky enough to actually be part of that we'll share with you throughout the program today. And Amy Poehler today, and Tina Fey, Maya Rudolph. The great Bill Zamy is going to be joining us today, who's the last person ever to interview Johnny Carson.
Right.
as we get ready for the premiere of Johnny Carson on our sister station, Antenna TV.
I think that's going to be neat.
It's, I've been looking at a lot of the clips because we put together some specials for it for TV. And it's pretty fun to watch some of these old Johnny Carson clips.
And, yeah, sure, maybe a bit of the monologue might be dated in some respects by the name of the person or something. But that, but they're still funny jokes.
It's, and you know, part of Carson's monologue is when the jokes weren't funny.
Right.
And how he reacted to that. But who doesn't love a good Reagan just fired all the
air traffic controllers
jokes? It's a lot of those that I've seen over the past couple of weeks. We'll talk more about it later on. Happy New Year to Rick.
Happy New Year, and I'll be listening.